The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I'm one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
My name's Jody Green, and I'm another host. I'm an extension educator from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And final host, Michael Scavarla, Penn State.
We're very proud and slightly embarrassed of our technological difficulties to welcome a guest to the show. Guest, will you introduce yourself to the Arthropod audience?
Yes, I am Greg Pask. I'm an assistant professor at Bucknell University in the Department of Biology and soon to be heading to Middlebury College in Vermont this summer.
Well, congratulations on the new gig. That sounds exciting.
It is. We're looking forward to it.
I guess we're all still staying home. It's a very different academic life right now. It's a very different entomological and extension life right now. So how are you guys doing? I just want to check in, make sure everybody's doing okay. Jody, are you living, surviving, thriving?
I'm happy now that bugs are out. I don't really understand why all the deans are implying that we have all this free time right now, and they keep having Zoom meetings to tell us what we can do with our free time. So I think I'm completing more tasks, but I still have everything started, right? I mean, you know me, I stay busy, but I'm grateful I still have a job and that I can still do what I love. But I do miss face-to-face education because it's kind of more of a performance, and I don't put words on my PowerPoint slide simply because I have really bad spelling and grammar. And now people are getting to realize that.
Mike, how are you doing? It's you and three kids and your wife and a dog. So, and however many plants.
Yep.
How are you doing?
Good, actually. My wife was a stay-at-home mom before all of this happened. So unlike a lot of, dual academic families where you're both professors, you're getting less done because somebody's doing childcare. My wife is amazing and takes the kids all day. So I come up, shut myself in the computer room and get to work. I'm getting a lot done. It has shifted a bit. I'm not getting as many IDs as I would expect for this time of year because the extension offices are closed, but I'm still getting a lot of computer work done and a lot of writing. I dusted off an unpublished chapter from my PhD dissertation and got that submitted to some co-authors. So I'm looking for stuff to get done and writing some fact sheets. I did manage to spend some time out in the garage and built a rack for some Berlaysia funnels I found in the Frost Museum here. So I'm going to go try to start producing my own samples to look at real bugs here now that it's warmed up again. So I brought a microscope home, so I've been curating a bit too.
That's awesome. Greg, yeah. How's it affecting you? Is your life continuing as per usual or has it been kind of interrupted?
It's been pretty good so far. The biggest switch was switching to remote teaching, which is not kind of anything close to what I try to do in the classroom. Thankfully, I have only 10 students in the class I'm teaching right now, and everybody's on the East Coast. So we're able to do a synchronous class where it's just a live check-in at our normal scheduled time. Hardest thing is we have a crayfish neurophysiology lab that we can't do remotely. I can't say hey, go out in the stream, find a crayfish and, stick some electrodes in it, hook it up to a little battery. Yeah. But that has kind of transformed into a research proposal. So that's been fun for them to kind of get more in depth on that. Other than that, my wife is at home. We actually are homeschooling our kids. We have 1 5-year-old and 1 2-year-old. So it's been nice to kind of be more a part of that when I'm usually at work. So I'm kind of able to engage in a lot of this stuff now. Doing math problems, teaching reading, all that good stuff. Been cooking a lot more, which has been fun.
Yeah.
And I've been playing a lot of games. You picked up that I'm a pretty big game nerd in many aspects and reading a lot of all that good stuff.
Sounds good. Catching up on some of the hobbies, it sounds like.
What about you, Jonathan?
Life has been pretty interrupted. I mean, my wife and I are both, we both work. And so we've had to figure out sort of a schedule at home to try and decide who's going to have the daughter when. And we're kind of getting it sorted out at this point. In terms of what I've been doing differently, I spend a lot of my time building pillow caves and pillow forts at this point. And we set up simulations in them so my daughter can like pretend to be a superhero saving the My Little Pony crew from the back of a cave that I've constructed. That's a little different than the most academic things I do, but it's almost nice, right? Like, if it weren't for the fact that there is a pandemic on, I'd be kind of happy about being able to spend this extra time with her. I think she's starting to get a little antsy. She's going to be 4 in November, and I think she kind of misses her friends at this point. She's realized now after almost 4 weeks that, wait a minute, it's been like Saturday for a long time. Do you guys have any funny stories from the quarantine period? Anything funny kind of going on, happy going on? Or I like sharing those kind of happy things.
Well, I do like getting your texts in the middle of the day, like, what's your favorite My Little Pony? But Taya has been putting on a costume for the last 3 days and walking around the neighborhood at 12:45. And she's got the little dog with her and she just walks around. She says she's spreading joy. And so I actually have, like, I was on a Zoom and I just saw her like walk up the street and then I wait for them to come back. But yesterday she was dressed like a mad scientist. So she had like a lab coat on and like this wig and like goggles and like rubber, like dish gloves. And she was walking around with this dog in a poop bag. And the day before that, she was dressed like a hula dancer with a ukulele and whatever. And then the day before that, she had one of those blow up sumo wrestling suits. And it's just her and that and this dog. And she's just walking around. She says she waves to people. People like in cars will stop and wave at her. She just thinks it's hilarious. And I like,
because it is
like, I haven't been with her. So she just goes and she comes back. So far, I haven't had to like leave a meeting to like, sorry, I've got to go. My daughter is with our dog in a costume somewhere in the neighborhood. I got to go. A parade of one. So that's my funny story.
Sounds like you have the best dress up in of all of us.
Mike, anything funny happening there?
Not funny. I'm debating whether I should share this story or not, but it's on Twitter, so I guess I can.
It's already in the zeitgeist.
It is. It's very instructive for my personality too, for those of you that don't follow me on Twitter. So I was playing outside taking a break with the kids and a deer got hit on the road right in front of my house. First I checked on the driver. He was shaken, but okay, and ended up getting a tow truck. But rather than let the deer go to waste, I dropped everything I was doing that day and butchered it on the spot. And now we have 15 pounds of deer meat in the freezer. Interesting story.
I would argue you're leaving out the part that's on Twitter and is the most interesting, which involved the head of the animal.
Oh, I do have a native mammal skull collection in my china cabinet, and I have recently added a deer skull to that collection. It's actually kind of neat because it was a button buck, so it was a deer that was born last year. The last set of molars in the back, my 5-year-old was really interested. He saw the butchering process, so now he knows where meat comes from. He was interested in that and then didn't want to eat the backstrap when I cooked it up. But my daughter, who also saw it, is 3. So they're finding out where that kind of stuff comes from. And I used the skull in some instructions this morning, like, here's the teeth. What do you think deer eat based on the teeth? Isn't this gap in the front teeth and the back teeth interesting? My wife was not a fan of the smell. Boiling skull is not.
They're not going to make a Yankee candle out of it anytime soon.
No. She's really sensitive to smells anyhow. Like, we can't wear cologne or perfumes, and I try to get, like, unscented deodorant even because it gives her a migraine. So I try to be real careful about that most of the time, but I didn't realize it would be so stinky.
Greg, can you top boiling a deer skull and traumatizing your own offspring for life?
I know it's, you know, in Pennsylvania, they just kind of said you have to start wearing masks, and we didn't have any you know, mask to put on. I had to go to the grocery store yesterday. But I did have my black balaclava that I use when I bike into work in the winter. So I went to the store with that on.
Nice.
Looked like I was going to rob the store. But they just started implementing like one-way aisles in the grocery store. And I was going the proper way, but some kind of, you know, game of chicken. But it turns out the balaclava won every time.
I don't know if I don't know if I have too many funny stories. We found termites on the property over the weekend. I was tearing out some old wood and found them. And I texted Jody because she's my personal county extension entomologist. And she was trying to...
I am wearing my termite.
She was just, you know, filling me in on termites a little bit. So we took most of the wood and burned it. And I haven't seen any since. I've been looking around and I haven't found any mud tubes on the house, but I'll probably be finding out what pest control under quarantine is like. That'll be kind of an interesting experience, I imagine. But that's just what we've been doing. It's been a good time, I guess, for some of us. We hope that all of you are doing well that are out there listening. If you need any help with anything, let us know. We'll try and do what we can. Even if it's just, you know, more podcasts, we'll try and make that happen so that you have something to listen to during the quarantine. But we are excited to have Greg on the show today. Greg reached out through Twitter to ask if he could be a guest. In terms of what kind of entomologist you are, just through perusing through your social media, I did read part of your dissertation a couple nights ago as well. It helped to make the outline for the show. Can you give the listeners just a broad overview, broad strokes of what kind of entomologist you are and how did you get interested in this field?
Well, it's, you know, it kind of took me a long time to kind of consider myself an entomologist. I kind of fell into, you know, entomology on accident. I was a biochemistry major in undergrad, chemistry research. And then I kind of took this elective that was a neurotransmitter dysfunction class. I'm like, oh, this is really cool. I like receptors. This could be a good place to go. I just recently, you know, at that time I committed to Vanderbilt for grad school. And one of my professors said, hey, there's this person who studies mosquitoes there. And they do some really cool stuff with smell receptors. And I'm like, oh, that'd be cool. And I looked in and that ended up being my dissertation lab. But I kind of was, you know, doing that work. We were working with mosquitoes, but we didn't really have, you know, a lot of entomological knowledge in the in our lab. And then I did this insect chemical ecology course. It was like a 2-week course. It was in Sweden. It actually moves around from Jena in Germany at the Max Planck Chemical Ecology Center. And then Sweden. And then it's actually, it was going to be in Penn State this summer, but I don't believe that's happening anymore. And that kind of really showed me how impactful a lot of this research can be. And I kind of pursued that ever since. We went around to like apple orchards where they're using some of these, this research to help growers, looked at how they preserve forests. One of the favorite things, they actually train German shepherds to smell the bark beetle pheromone. And we followed these German shepherds around as they, you know, found these bark beetle infested trees and then barked, and then they got rewarded with some meatballs.
That's awesome. So it sounds like you work a lot with insect olfaction, insect smell, just based on what I was reading through and everything. That's a very particular area of research. So did your biochemistry background, did that help lead you into that? Or what is it that interested you in that particular area of entomology?
I think what started, I always was really into smells, oddly. like chemistry research. There were certain products that we made that had like a minty smell. And I'm like, oh, this is really cool. I still remember like the organic lab, we were doing clove oil extractions. And I'm like, this is great. This is eugenol. And I think that kind of started to help me kind of get a really good founding in some of the chemical ecology side of it, as opposed to, you know, people coming in from biology, they typically kind of, the odorant molecule is like comes in and binds to the receptor. I'm like, no, that thing has a structure. And we can kind of start to predict some of their function based on that structure.
Did you used to sniff things and people when you were a kid? Like, have you always been obsessed with smelling?
I think I've always been kind of really into smells. My mom would say that if she were on this podcast too. and flavors and that. So yeah, like kind of going through the spice cabinets. I definitely tend to spice things and season things a lot more than most.
Yeah, that's cool. You could be like a flavor chemist or...
Except I decided to stick with insects.
So in terms of insect olfaction, in terms of insect smell, can you give the listeners kind of a broad overview about how that works? I mean, I've never seen a nose on an insect. So can you explain to the folks listening at home, just how does an insect receive this kind of information? And then how do they interpret it even?
Yes. So insects have all of these, they have kind of two main olfactory appendages. The primary one are the antennae. And then also you have the maxillary palps sometimes. And sometimes other mouth parts can have some olfactory capabilities to them. But all of these appendages are covered in all these different types of sensory hairs called scintilla. some of these are olfactory scintilla. And the walls of these little hairs, they have all different types of olfactory scintilla, and the walls of them are all covered in all these little tiny holes or pores. And that is kind of like the nostrils of the insect nose, where all these molecules that are in the environment can traverse through those pores and then interact with sensory neurons inside those different sensory hairs. Each one of those sensory neurons kind of specializes in picking up a certain subset of odors. And then every single olfactory receptor neuron, these sensory neurons that have the same receptor that they express, all converge in this one integration center of the brain called the antennal lobe. So in the antennal lobe, that's where all of this gets processed and then sent to higher brain centers. They can either go to the mushroom body, which is where a lot of olfactory learning takes place, or if they're things that are like innate smell that they don't want to learn to associate them with certain things, things like pheromones, that you don't want to change your perception of that. They go directly, bypass that learning center of the mushroom body in the brain, and go right to an area called the lateral horn, where they then can go downstream and affect various behaviors and physiology.
Like, what are they smelling? Why do they need to smell?
Smelling is kind of one of their main senses in a lot of different insect species. Especially, you always see this with insects that have really huge and ornate and, you know, fluffy antenna, that they are really using these very, you know, they've dedicated a lot of body resources to those antenna. So one of the things that they are really trying to smell are semiochemicals. And these are kind of, think of them as like messages with a meaning. Mm-hmm. So one type of semiochemical that I've already alluded to are pheromones. And these are any sort of compound that helps communication within a species. So it could be a mating pheromone or a sex pheromone that's helping them find a mate. It could be an alarm pheromone where, like, hey, you know, a bunch of aphids are getting eaten by this ladybug. They're going to release this alarm pheromone to let the rest of their colony know. And you can also have different pheromones, which you kind of think about chemical communication in terms of the emitter who's releasing that signal and the receiver. And pheromones are a class that is across species where the benefits are for the receiver. So something like for us humans, something that we have to deal with now, you know, as it gets warmer, a mosquito is going to smell our body odor and our, you know, the components of our sweat. That doesn't benefit us when a mosquito smells that. The mosquito gets all the benefits because now they found a suitable host that they can, you know, orient towards and land on and bite. You can also have things that benefit the emitter. These are called allomones. Allomones are things that, think of them as kind of a lot of defense compounds, like Eleodes beetles kind of release this chemical and it prevents, you know, very acrid smelling, you know, you don't like to smell it, you know, but it prevents a lot of predators from getting them. And then things that benefit both. And these are known as cinnamones. Think a classic example here would be the odors that a flower releases to attract a pollinator. You know, the pollinator is getting a benefit, and so is the flower itself. Also, various foods have different odors that they can pick up and say, hey, here's our actual host plant. And you can also use it to smell problems. Like, hey, we're living on this food, but there's some harmful microbes that we don't want to interact with. Let's move away because we can smell that. Or even a nice example from ants, and, you know, it's very relevant in the current time, is if an ant gets infected with some sort of fungus, you know, fungal infection like cordyceps, ants practice social distancing when they're sick. They will pick up that infected ant and remove it from the colony so it doesn't release its spores and infect other members of the colony.
Even ants have this thing down. It's amazing. We should follow their example.
I feel like I could do a whole show on why ants are better than humans.
So I remember back in when I was an undergrad, it took me a long time to get all the names straight, like pheromones and allomones and what they all meant. So correct me if I'm wrong, but a chemical, how you classify it is going to depend on your perspective. So if it's a pheromone between like a male and a female moth, but another predator is cueing in on that pheromone, then it's a pheromone for the predator, but it's still a pheromone between those two moths. So it depends on how you're looking at it. Is that true?
That is exactly right. Yeah, okay. you can have, especially some of these, a lot of parasitoids can kind of hone in on certain areas where you have a lot of this host, and they'll use those, you know, pheromones that that one host species is gay with each other to say, hey, there's my host, let me lay my egg.
That, I think that idea was the hardest thing for me to wrap my head around. Because, like, you know, words have definitions, like it's a caramone or it's an allomone, and just the idea that depending on how you look at it and what you are in the relationship can alter how we define it was difficult to wrap my head around. I wanted to jump back to something that you said a couple of minutes ago, though, to Sensilla, because one thing I think people have heard a lot of is like this idea that butterflies can taste with their feet. Is that similar? Like, are they using similar structures to do that? Is that true? If that's something our listeners have heard. And with the sensilla, are they kind of analogous to other CD on the body? Like, if you've got, say, a gene duplication or something going on with DNA, can you move those sensilla in place of other CD on other parts of the body? Does that question make sense?
It does. Yeah. There have been, most of these kind of genetic mutations and manipulations have been done in Drosophila, where they can kind of get rid of whole entire classes of sensilla and kind of use that to really, you know, form some groundbreaking studies that identified what their roles were. But yeah, the taste, so going back to the taste sensilla, any sensilla that is, you know, for taste, typically has it's not covered with a bunch of small pores. They kind of have this terminal pore at the very end that some large opening that's going to allow for, you know, largely aqueous, substrates to kind of interface with all the neurons within it. And those are located on butterfly feet. I actually taught maybe 3 years ago now, there was a insect pest management course that I taught for non-majors. And that was one of our labs that we did, where we said, hey, here's an adult butterfly. How is it tasting the sugar water that we're providing it? And they just kind of took a Q-tip and poked around, and they would touch those front legs, and hey, now we got a proboscis extension. So yeah, taste receptors tend to be more spread out. There's some evidence that some insects have taste receptors on their ovipositors. Some are found in their tarsi, their feet, and also their mouth parts. And also some evidence that they might be in the wing margin of insects, which, you know, the function of a lot of these areas is relatively unknown. Olfaction seems to generally be limited to a lot of the antenna and maxillary palps, especially because they can generate all this extra surface area for an interaction surface.
Huh. I guess I just would have assumed that those two things would have been more similar or like related if you're tasting the air and tasting liquids, but that's interesting that they're not.
I think that's an interesting perspective. It was something I was trying to look around about, because I think to humans, olfaction and taste are kind of gustatory, right? Is that the right word? Gustation?
Gustation is taste. Yeah.
Okay. Those are kind of linked for us, but I would take it that's not the case for insects. They don't have that same kind of intrinsic link. Like cinnamon rolls don't smell and taste to them at the same time like they do for us.
I don't think so.
They'll never understand why I love cinnamon rolls so much. So in terms of studying this kind of stuff, it just seems like it's been such a fertile piece of entomological history. It's been something that you can even go all the way back to Fabre, and you can see him working on it. I have these cool little Fabre action figures that I got off of eBay from Japanese 7-Elevens. And one of them is actually the experiment that he did where he had the female moth in the glass container and the male moths could still smell her and fly up to it. So in terms of the history of this, has it been something that's been important to entomology? What has been that history? Like, what are some of the famous experiments in insect olfaction?
Yeah, and you mentioned that. See, I always refer to Jean-Henri as Fabre.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know either.
But I am very jealous of those action figures.
You might be able to still find them. I got them pretty cheap on eBay. Just look up, I think it's like Japanese 7-Eleven Jean-Henri toys. And yeah, apologies to the nation of France if I've butchered your beautiful language.
But yeah, he has some of the earliest like documented insect smell research. I actually included it in my dissertation defense, like a whole little, you know, preamble about it, where, you know, this classic experiment where he trapped this giant peacock moth under this like wire cage. And then his, I think his nephew or son comes running in saying there's like swarms and hordes of male moths flying around. And I include the quote. It's such a good quote that and he writes it so beautifully. I don't want to butcher it. So I made sure it was up on my screen here. It says, "Coming from every direction and apprised I know not how, here are 40 lovers eager to pay their respects to the marriageable bride born that morning amid the mysteries of my study." it's just so beautiful. I really wish papers were written that way.
You just don't see it anymore. You don't see anybody say it like that.
No, that doesn't. I should try that. See if it gets past the reviewer.
Reviewer Practice three would it. Hammer you.
Practice it on Twitter. Just like what you write and like how you know, your interpretation.
This could be a good bioarchive test to see how a preprint handles that. but yeah, so he did all this early work and found that like, hey, it had to be some sort of smell because once he took that female out of the cage, the males were still going for that empty cage. And that was that was way back in the 1870s. And it took almost 100 years to get our first insect pheromone discovered, in the domestic silk moth, Bombyx mori. And then, you know, after that, they said, hey, we can, you know, get, you know, identify these pheromones. They moved into a lot of pest insects and then found that, hey, we could take some of, you know, so they identified all these pheromones that were behaviorally active. And then they said, all right, well, what's receiving the signal? And, you know, people that are kind of my ilk started to rip off antenna, keep them alive, stick electrodes in and see if applying odors triggered some sort of electrical impulse. And they found that it did. And then, you know, some of the key work, especially in my area of interest, is that the actual olfactory receptor genes weren't discovered until 1999. They, you know, they were very different. They took a long time since they identified the genes in mammals. So insects and mammals have completely different mechanisms for actually receiving these smells from the environment. Insects use ion channels, and we humans use something called G-protein coupled receptors, which, you know, a lot of mammals and other kinds of animals use. And kind of now in the genetic age, we're getting more and more of these olfactory receptors genes being identified. The only issue is that there's this rate limiting step of like, how does each gene function, which takes a lot longer than just annotating the gene sequence. And my lab's research is really trying to make a dent in that functionalization void.
So what are some techniques that you use in that arena? I mean, I think you kind of hinted at some of them before where you were talking about those terrible torturing insect kind of things where you were stabbing things into them. Can you talk just a little bit more about that kind of approach? And then is that still what you're using, or do you have some more elegant, modern type solutions?
It's kind of a bit of both. My graduate work, we were taking olfactory receptor genes from mosquitoes and putting them into like a mammalian cell culture line. So cells in a dish that we could just, you know, stick electrodes in a cell and do some studies there. And that really worked well when we were talking about like human sweat components and other, you know, various odors that mosquitoes like. When I switched to ants, the thing that we were really interested were these cuticular hydrocarbons. So all these really waxy, hydrophobic, so like water-hating molecules that we needed to figure out how ants were using them to communicate. Turns out, you know, cells in a dish don't like things that are really waxy. So we came up with this new approach to where we could isolate a single, it's been used before, but it's, you can isolate a single, olfactory gene, and we would insert that gene into a Drosophila, the common vinegar fly. With that, we would then stick an electrode. We could tell, using the genetics of the fruit fly system, we could use that to say, hey, we want our new ant receptor expressed in this specific set of olfactory scintilla. And then we can go in with an electrode. We actually take the fly, we shove it up a plastic pipette tip and have its antenna just poke out a little bit. And then we drive a sharp electrode into a single hair on the antenna of a vinegar fly.
Wow.
And puff odors on and see, hey, this fly couldn't respond to this odor before, but now we put this ant gene in and now it can respond to that odor. We now know what this ant receptor responds to.
What do they respond to?
So my recent papers have been about, hey, we found all these cuticular hydrocarbons that vary between different castes of ants. And we found that these ant receptors can respond to sometimes a couple molecules that are related, but sometimes they can actually discern differences from a single carbon. So one might have, you know, C30, you know, 31 carbons and all connected in a chain. Another might have 32, and this receptor can differentiate between those two.
They're amazing little machines.
They are.
So that differentiation, is it just the receptor, like it's acting like a lock and key mechanism, and it's just that sensitive to, say, that last carbon hanging off the end?
Exactly. That's what we believe. There still is no structure on actually like what the binding pocket of these receptors might look like. It's actually, if you think about it, with all the insects that are in the world, it's like the largest family of receptors that you can think of. But yeah, trying to understand how that binds is kind of one of our earlier future questions, where we're trying to say, hey, how have these really closely related genes kind of evolved and diverged in their functions? Maybe the one that, you know, receptor A doesn't respond to, receptor B will, and now they've kind of differentiated and have this really high discriminating olfactory system.
So I've got a couple questions that kind of branch off that. I'm not sure which one to start. When you put these ant genes into Drosophila, do you notice the Drosophila act any differently now that they have this capability to smell other things or not?
That's a really good question. I'll admit oftentimes we just kind of leave them in the vial and let them do their thing. The nice thing is the hydrocarbons that are present naturally on Drosophila are way shorter than what would be found in ants. So I don't think the Drosophila are actually encountering any sort of, you know, compound that is going to activate these receptors in that little food vial that we keep them in. But we haven't tested that yet. I mean, people have done other similar work. Say, hey, if we put in these different receptors into these neurons, can we actually learn how these cells function? Like, what's the circuitry? And what does it, you know, does it lead to an attraction response? Does it lead to a repulsion response? But we don't really do that because they just don't really, you know, one of the benefits is that they don't really respond to the native Drosophila odors. If not, that would be a big mess.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess the other question I had is, I saw on your website that you're working with Hypognathus saltator, yes. The Indian jumping ant. If I remember correctly, they're reasonably primitive for ants. They're a Ponerine. So is there any particular reason you picked that over, say, native species that might be easier to collect here? And do you have the ants like in colony with you, or are you just working with like the genome because you're taking out genes and putting them in Drosophila? Like, you need the ants in-house to do that work?
Excellent question. So to start with Harpinathos saltator, yes, we like that species because of its primitive eusocial status. They have this really unique colony structure where most ant colonies, if you get rid of the queen, like the queen dies or you remove her, the rest of the colony will eventually die out. They might produce some male offspring and kind of send them elsewhere to mate with other, to mate with virgin queens from other colonies. But the Harpinathus saltator, this Indian jumping ant, will actually look around and they have this big dominance tournament. It's kind of like a battle royale where a bunch of workers will have maybe about, you know, 1 to 2 weeks of dueling where they're battling each other with antennae. Biting, policing, and then eventually one emerges as the new reproductive. So instead of a true queen, they call her a gamergate. It's kind of like a princess, but still will carry on reproductive duties for that colony. We're interested in the fact of like, hey, when can these ants smell that there's a reproductive gone to start engaging in this tournament? And then so another reason, because of this unique social structure, it really helps us in rearing them in the lab. We do have these ants, or I had these ants before the shutdown. Because I was moving, it didn't make sense for me to continue to rear them and then transport them. I have collaborators that can to help provide me with new colonies when I settle in Vermont. But yeah, we would have like about 20, 25 colonies going at once. And they're really easy to take care of. I kind of fell in love with ants because of this, is that you just kind of throw in some live crickets. They'll sting them and paralyze them, and then the larva will just suck the hemolymph out. And then they just pile up all their trash, the carcasses and the waste, in a corner. So I just kind of throw in live crickets, scoop out the trash, and that's it for each colony.
Oh, that's really cool. Is there any, so they're not native, is there any problem with like USDA permitting? Because I assume you have to have some kind of permission from somebody to have them.
Yes, we have USDA permits from APHIS, PP&Q, to make sure that they do not leave, especially with this kind of reproductive capacity. Like, hey, if they get out there, could they start a colony in Pennsylvania? You know, I think it might be a little too temperate here, but that is a concern. So we have all sorts, USDA approved room and all that good stuff.
Are they your favorite ant?
I think because I spend the most time with them, they are up there, but I really love these weaver ants that are kind of, link up to each other. They, will bite the legs and hold on, and while they kind of use them as rope, like living ropes, to pull leaves together. And then they even get the youth involved. They have the larva that will spin and produce silk and use that to weave these leaves together. And then they can make a nest from these woven leaves. And they're actually, I think they're the oldest documented biocontrol strategy, where I think it was in like around the 300s AD in China. They were actually using these in citrus groves as to ward off pests, and they actually attached ropes from tree to tree to help them move around the grove.
Cool.
That's an awesome story.
That is cool.
Gamergate must have been really a bummer for you in terms of hashtags for your research on Twitter.
It really does. People are familiar with the term, but not the definition.
Right.
This is off topic in a different way. Have you ever seen the movie Them?
I have seen parts of it. There was actually one of my colleagues screened it at the local campus movie theater, but I did not make it out to it. But I'm familiar with it. I just haven't seen it. Maybe now quarantine is the time to dive into it.
Yeah, you should check it out. You should like tweet while you're watching it, because we watched it and then we did a podcast after. And every now and then I get like the sound of it that the ants make in my head too, along with Frozen song, and it makes me laugh.
Mike, what's the noise again? You did a pretty good impression of it.
No, I can't. It's so good and so bad all at the same time. I enjoyed it as a movie. I highly suggest watching it once.
Yeah, I think all of us like just kind of love ants, so it's a good bonding organism for the four of us.
So it sounds like in terms of studying olfaction and insects, it's a pretty fertile field for people to use in terms of preventing pests. I know that Jody and I, we talk a lot about to people things like baits or pheromone traps and things of that nature and repellents. Is your work applicable in those areas? Like, I know it's basic research and it's not necessarily applied, but are the things you're discovering going to help us to keep repellents on the market and understand baits better as well?
Yes, kind of sometimes indirectly. And I would love to move towards more applied, agricultural uses. So in my grad work, we found this kind of really unusual molecule that can kind of activate every olfactory receptor across all of insects. And it was kind of targeted. I mean, I used it for like a research tool to understand how these things work, but some of the press that it got called it like a weapon of mass destruction for insects. Another paper called it the next silent spring, which was kind of hard to hear.
Ooh.
Wow.
Even though we're not talking about use, I'm just saying, hey, we're using this molecule to understand how these things work at the molecular level. It kind of really paved the way for my dissertation. But yeah, kind of like responsible, just like any blanket insecticide type or repellent, responsible use is really key. What this kind of work really, like insect olfaction work, really presents as a really powerful and sustainable option is using these really specific pheromones in ways that are targeted towards your pest species. That could be in terms of, hey, you set a pheromone in a trap and you're using it for surveillance to see if you need to make economic decisions for your crops. If you realize you have an issue, now you might be able to get some of this mass-produced pheromone and use it for like a mass trapping strategy where you're just, hey, come in here, a trap and kill approach. One of the fun ones that I really like, and I got to do this with that pest management class, is called mating disruption, where you get these little pieces of like red plastic typically, and they're impregnated with the pheromone of interest that you, of the pest that you're using, that you're trying to beat. And you can then take these little pheromone ties and tie them to every single tree in your orchard. We were doing this in an Asian pear orchard. So then when that male comes in, it's smelling the pheromone and thinks it's going to find a female. And all of a sudden it finds this red piece of plastic. It's a buzzkill. So then, you know, that can kind of just really help crash and keep populations down. It's been really effective in the past. The best use is probably codling moth, apple codling moth. So different approaches there. We're getting into things where we're looking at different beetle species that might be agricultural pests, trying to get a handle on how these pheromone receptors evolve. And how can we might be able to use that to predict future issues with using some of these strategies.
I have sort of a love-hate relationship with some of these pheromone traps, because you look at some of them and they're beautiful and awesome, just like you're talking about with codling moth and some of these other apple orchard type pests. But my big experience with them has been Japanese beetle pheromone traps. And it's so powerful, and it works too well. It brings so many bugs to your yard. It's not really all that effective in the end, but it is amazing technology to think that we can take this thing that they came up with and use it against them. So that's interesting. I appreciate hearing about that.
And that's why I kind of really like that mating disruption. So like, even if you, like, if you do bring them all to the yard, all of a sudden they're not able to reproduce as efficiently.
Right.
That female who's calling is now competing with every single pheromone dispenser you put around the orchard.
Can I ask you about repellents? I'm a mosquito magnet, and I know that a lot of your research and your graduate work was about repellents. So do insect repellents make it impossible for the insect to sense the human, or that they can't land, or what's, I guess this, is it, it doesn't affect them like physically at all, or they are just not able to take a blood meal?
Well, that's a great question, and one that we're still trying to work through. I pledged to myself that I would never touch any research associated with DEET, just because DEET works so well, but we still have really no idea of how exactly it works. The best evidence seems to be that it's multimodal, that it's going to be working on olfactory system and then also the taste system, and also might have other aspects in affecting mosquito physiology. But yeah, it's so effective. Like if you apply DEET to yourself, you find that it has a really kind of low vapor pressure, where that's why it lasts so long, that if a mosquito comes, a mosquito will get pretty close to you while you're wearing DEET, mm-hmm. but it just might come like a couple inches away and decide not to land, which is also why like making sure that you cover every exposed surface is important with those. I've actually been using a lot more, and my issue with DEET, there's a lot of, you know, scary, yeah. You know, pseudoscience around why you shouldn't use DEET, and the same company will market to both demographics. But it's a plasticizer. It will dissolve so that's why I don't like to use it. That's
I've ruined many watches and sunglasses.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've started to use is kind of some of these essential, like the marketed essential oil ones from like, you know, Repel or Off, where it's like I think it's lemon eucalyptus. It doesn't last as long, but it kind of gives a bigger cloud of protection. Mm-hmm. And it's usually just kind of finding, you know, plants have evolved these kind of scents to repel insects that they don't want for, you know, a couple million years. So kind of using some of those can be really effective. Like when people talk about essential oils, there's a lot of bunk out there as well.
Mm-hmm.
But this actually, it does work. We had a nice fun experiment where we had like vinyl dishwashing gloves, which are probably really hard to find these days. And you cut the lab I was in for a postdoc came up with this idea, is you cut a little window in the top of it for your hand, and then you can like stack different nets on it so that you can prevent the mosquitoes from biting you. And you just treat the different nets with different repellents, and you see how well they, you know, how likely they are to come and try to probe and bite you through the mesh. And some of these like essential oils, there's, you know, various kinds. There's also, what is it that's going to come? There's like the IR-3535 is another popular repellent.
Yeah, that they work. Picaridin?
And picaridin as well, yeah. And they all work pretty well. We've essentially been saying, all right, what repellent can we use that also works really well for ticks? And picaridin has been one of those that has been strong.
Mm-hmm. it very specific to flies versus ticks?
That's some of the things that I think people are trying to say, because they would love to market it for every single biting insect. Some of the ones that I'm not really sure, like things like kissing bugs, especially down in like the Southwest and South America, how effective they are for those kinds of insects. But mostly they're looking at ones that work on like biting flies, different diptera. But one of the things that came out just when we found this molecule during my grad work, there was this CDC study that found that a grapefruit peel extract called Nucatone was like a waste product for grapefruit processing. And it was also really effective as a repellent for ticks and mosquitoes. And I got my hands on some of that and it worked pretty well. I'm just waiting for it to kind of be a more popular thing on the market.
Yeah, it's so hard to transfer it from those peels to something that can be used. You know, as an extension educator, we get phone calls like, if I put grapefruit peels all over my house, will it repel mosquitoes?
Yeah.
And you're like,
yeah, it's hard. But the nice thing is it's already been like approved and for like fragrances and flavorings. So like that's like a big, mass production company. Like when I was in grad school, I'm like, hey, can I get some of this? And they're like, oh, free sample, 5 grams. I'm like, that's a lot.
Wow.
Okay, cool. I used it camping.
Yeah, and that smell isn't bad. I mean, there's a stuff when people are like, oh, I mixed all these essential oils together. I'm like, wow, you must smell really bad.
Garlic. Garlic is big with some of that crowd. It seems like they just want to bathe in garlic, and they think that'll keep the mosquitoes away because they're tiny vampires, I guess. I'm not sure.
I don't know.
I think that's definitely added to the lore of the garlic.
It's like, what's that smell? It's me, but I'm not getting bitten by mosquitoes.
So kind of getting back to your research a bit, but also, the fact that you're at Bucknell, which is a small liberal arts college. I think they've got 3,000 or 4,000 students. You're moving to Middlebury, another small liberal arts college. According to Wikipedia, they've got like 2,500 students.
Mm-hmm.
John, Jody, and I are all from large land grants, with 20 to 40,000 students. So it's a very different experience compared to anything we've done. And the research you're doing is all very, I imagine, involved and whatnot. So how do you bring primarily undergrads into your lab and get them working on insect olfaction? Like it, for something like I do with phylogenetics or natural history, like it, getting undergrads to go trap insects and identify them and compare trap counts seems easy. How do you translate what you do to like bringing undergrads into the lab and getting them lab experience?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's something that I've kind of, decided early on in my career. I'm like, hey, this is the kind of school I want to go to. I went to a small liberal arts school in Eastern Pennsylvania at Muhlenberg College in Allentown. And I was like, hey, I am in labs doing research. I'm not just doing dishes, which is really nice. And I've kind of set up what I do to work only with undergrads. Nice thing is sometimes if you get them early, you might have 3 or 4 years with them. And they can really kind of develop some nice skill sets, especially if they're spending time in the summer where I have more time to help train them. But yeah, there's kind of different phases. Some undergrads in our lab do a lot of behavioral studies. We're actually using Raspberry Pis to like easily monitor ant behaviors and other insects and actually other animals that we're trying to get going and plants. But, other people really like the electrophysiology, the sticking of the electrodes into the olfactory antenna. I have 2 students who unfortunately I have to leave before their senior year, Lydia and Deanna, that just they take to that electrophysiology rig so well and they can just step in and get recordings. And once they get efficient and doing that, I'm like, I need to keep them going. I need to keep them, occupied with as many fly lines as I can. So it's definitely a skill that I have to make sure that the students that are really apt and capable of doing that can go for it. I'm also benefiting that electrophysiology is something that every single neuroscience major learns in their education, in their classes. But there's not many lab opportunities, whether it's a teaching lab or a research lab, for them to actually do it. I actually present that opportunity to them. So usually I have no problem attracting students kind of interested in tackling those kinds of techniques. But it's definitely different. I spend a lot of my time helping support them. I'm kind of like a PI slash postdoc slash tech slash like lab manager technician all at once.
Wow.
Trying to make sure everybody's stocked. But I also get to do this stuff all the time. I get to go in and, you know, hop on the electrophysiology rigs where I think if I were at an R1, I'd be mostly talking with postdocs, graduate students, and trying to get money.
Mm-hmm.
That is very true. That is the experience I see with other people. So, well, that's really cool. Cause yeah, like I said, the small liberal arts college is just, I am not familiar with that, I guess, at all. So it's just a very different experience.
Yeah, when I've given seminars at kind of larger schools, that's what all the grad students want to talk to me about, which is really fun to kind of say, hey, even if you didn't go to a school like this, you can kind of see what it's like and see if it's something that you want to pursue in the future.
Well, with that, I think we're going to transition towards the end of the episode here today. I want to say thanks, Greg, for being on the podcast with us. We like to end our episodes by humanizing the scientists that we've talked to. We know that a lot of people's perceptions of scientists are that all we think about is science. All we think about is bugs. We must just be insect automatons. And so we do have some off-the-wall kind of questions usually we like to ask people. One of them I didn't put on the list of questions I sent you, but that we enjoy asking folks is, if you could have an arthropod-based superpower, what would you have?
Oh, I feel like I should say something olfactory-based.
You can play to type, or you can be honest and tell us the truth.
I love Spider-Man, and being able to easily walk up walls and on top of like ceilings and things, I think would be an amazing ability.
I'm right there with you.
Would be in my way.
Yeah. Spider-Man has some of the best powers in the comic book world, like walking up walls, the panels where he's just like casually walking up and talking to himself. I want that in my life. Something fierce.
Yeah.
So you've hit on another thing that I kind of noticed based on some imagery through your Twitter. One of the pictures, in fact, I think it's your Skype photograph here, is of a crocheted Ant-Man and Ant. So yes, are you a comic book fan?
I am a huge comic book fan. It's been helping me during this quarantine. I think I've read through maybe like 5 or 6 different story arcs in the last 2 weeks.
Nice.
It's all through digital comics. My wife and I are going through the Marvel Cinematic Universe in release order right now.
Okay.
And we're trying to pair that with the movie. We just finished Captain America Winter Soldier, and we're pairing that with the comic as well. But yeah, I like a lot of especially the Marvel cosmic stories, like Guardians of the Galaxy, Captain Marvel, Thor, like the Ragnarok movie that came out. I really like those kinds of movies and comics as well.
Yeah, Thor is one of my favorites. I'm trying to collect all of Thor throughout his entire history. I've got a lot of the Marvel Epic collections and some of the other trade paperbacks. I'm trying to do it wire to wire. I want to have all of Thor. And I've joked around with another buddy of mine that I want to do a podcast with him called Are You There, Thor? It's me, Josh, or John. It's us, Josh and John. So yeah, I love some comic books too. I've been reading some things. I just finished The Terrifics here recently.
Nice.
Doing some DC, doing a little bit of Marvel. I don't know that the other two can geek out with us on this comic book type stuff, though.
No. Well, John got me into comics when we lived together as undergrads, but I am not a big fan of superheroes, so I tend to go towards like small press comics.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a reasonably sized collection at this point, but have you heard of Six Gun from?
I have not.
What is that? Oni? It's like a fantasy sci-fi western, I guess, but that ended up being one of my favorites. But yeah, so John tried to get me into superhero comics, and it just didn't. I never found anything that I really connected with, but I found other comics outside of superheroes that I really enjoy.
You did like to treat me like a comic book or a superhero Wikipedia sometimes. Like you would just say, like, tell me everything about Superman, go. And I would.
I love the lore. If you could just tell me about it in a Wikipedia style conversation, I will sit there and listen for hours. But I don't enjoy reading the comics for some reason. I like the movies. Anyway, that's my contribution to that.
Jody, you've never read a comic book, have you?
Nope.
I have to change that. I'll have to send you one in the mail. Maybe Ant-Man and the Wasp.
I have a question though about, but this has to do with smelling. It's related to smell and insects, but in a different way. It's for Greg. So what insect do you think smells the worst?
I feel like I haven't smelled as many insects as I would have liked, which is an odd thing to say. but the one that really irks me the most is the brown marmorated stink bug smell, because they'll just kind of, you know, crawl in. If I'm like, say I'm like reading a comic at night, and all of a sudden I'll just like hear some wings fluttering around my head, and all of a sudden like one lands on me, and I'm just like, oh man, yep, there's the smell. you know, they invaded, I think it was actually in Allentown, Pennsylvania originally.
Yeah.
Where they were founded. So yeah, that one is a particular, brings bad memories. My college roommate had like an electric teapot. And one time he found that there was just like, I think he was drinking stink bug tea for a while. But like he would, you know, he would just fill it up all the way, heat it up, just pour what he needed, and had one of those little filters. And there were a bunch of stink bugs in there one day.
Yeah, they smell so bad. We've started getting them here. People are getting a few in their house. And I'm like, this is not even like how it is in the East Coast. Like the way you said, oh yeah, when I'm going to bed and there's one flying around my head, that, like, just that you said that, you know, people would go nuts because they're not used to seeing any of them. So just even one. I got to smell a vivid metallic ground beetle the other day when I went to pick it up to show my daughter, and it stunk. It smelled so bad. I was shocked. I was like, and I say this out loud to myself, wow, you stink. And like, have you ever smelled a green lacewing?
I have not.
I think they smell like mothballs, like naphthalene. And I've never had anyone really ever say that besides me, but I don't know if I just smell bugs.
Jody treats insects like scratch and sniff.
I think they smell like the adult. I think after picking it up, like on the wings, looking at it, taking a picture, putting it back, I smell naphthalene. And then I think bed bugs smell terrible. They give me a headache. And then I don't mind the odorous house ants, but I tell people to tell me if they smell.
I like the odorous house ant smell. I don't like dead Japanese beetles. That one is that's a bad memory for me.
Yeah. But the brown marmorated stink bug, so stinky.
There was a nice citizen science thing of like, what do you think the odorous house ant smells like? And it revealed olfactory differences in humans. Some people thought it smelled like blue cheese and they liked it. Other people thought it smelled different and they did not like it.
Huh. Yeah. Sometimes we smell ants and we're like, what does that smell like? And Jonathan was like, it smells pavement anty.
I don't do as many IDs in the field, but my ID founding story was when I was out with the class trying to find ants, and it was these yellow, small little yellow ants. I'm like, what are these? And then I'm like, I think I have an idea. And I squished it and smelled the citronella. I'm like, I know exactly what species this is. And that's the peak of my taxonomic identification.
Oh, that's perfect. That's a great way to identify that subgenus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think we've done a great job of humanizing scientists here. We love weird things, and we like to crush bugs and smell them. We're just that kind of odd. Greg, we want to say thank
Everybody
you for being on
get
the
on board.
Yeah, exactly. They need to get on board and smell some bugs. Thanks for being on the show. We really appreciate it. This was a great conversation. Is there anywhere that people can find? Is there somewhere that people can find you on the internet if they want to follow your entomological escapades and see you crushing and sniffing ants?
I am most active on Twitter, where it's G_PASK, PASK.
So give Greg a follow on that platform. If you want to find the show on Twitter, we are Arthro_PodShow. I am @BugmanJohn on that platform.
I'm @JodyBugsMeUNL.
And I'm @MScavarla36.
And if you have ideas for shows in the future, if you want to be a guest, hit us up on that platform. We'd be happy to chat with you, hear what you have to say. We've got a little bit of backlog from some listeners about things that they'd like to hear about, including some fossil entomology ideas that maybe we'll parse through as a group. But we like to have that feedback. And if you want to support the show, find us on any of your different podcatching apps and give us a rating and give us a review. It helps the people out there to find the show. So thanks for tuning in. Hope you're all doing well, and we will catch you in a couple weeks on another episode of Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
At one point, you want to talk about the fact that you, like, stab their tiny brains with needles, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to ask about that.